Welcome everyone here in the room and also online. It is my great pleasure to welcome Sandra Young tonight. This is one of the talks of the Center of Cultural Inquiry, and we do this in cooperation with the NOMIS research group Traveling Forms. Sandra Young is also currently a short-time fellow of the research group Traveling Forms, and we are particularly interested in her research because she covers an impressive geographic and historical range from the early modern period to today with an outlook to the future, I think. And her book on Shakespeare in the Global South has already become a classic. In that book, Sandra looks at a broad range of adaptations, for example, in Mauritius, North India, Brazil, South Africa, but also, and I think quite importantly, the Global South in your definition includes places in the Global North. So it's not really a geographical clear dividing line. And what is maybe interesting for us is that this book came out in a series that is called Global Shakespeare Inverted, at Bloomsbury in the Art and Shakespeare series. And that series is interested in inverting our usual divisions of the globe, of space, in our thinking about centers and peripheries. And Sandra is really at the forefront of examining such critical concepts. And her book not only offers a really fascinating range of case studies about how Shakespeare has been adapted in these various contexts, but it also, importantly, questions the very terms that we use to understand such arrivals of Shakespeare at other places. And this is something that is also especially important for our work in the group of Traveling Forms, because you really engage with the questions of how do forms travel. And the book, I can only recommend it, critically questions concepts like creolization, indigenization, localization, Africanization, and diaspora, and really invites us to rethink these concepts. Sandra's earlier book looked at the early modern Global South in print, so she really looked at sort of the prehistory of that concept of the Global South. It looked at, and this is the subtitle, at textual form and the production of human difference as knowledge. So really the early modern foundation of our modern or maybe postmodern concepts that are still influential today. Currently, Sandra is working on an edited collection together with her colleague Chris Thurman. It is entitled Global Shakespeare and Social Injustice Towards a Transformative Encounter. So the term form once again comes up as transformation, as a transformative encounter. Sandra has also written on protest forms in South Africa, and this is also something that is important for the anthropological project in our Traveling Form group, so it really brings together the interdisciplinary interest that we have. And in May 2023, Sandra and again her colleague Chris Thurman will host a conference called Shakespeare Towards an End in Cape Town. So she keeps working on these questions that she's already explored in her book and that she will explore today. And I was very glad to see that we've also gathered a very international group of colleagues in our online community, ranging from Cape Town via Bayreuth, Konstanz, Munich, and so on. So I think here we can already see how influential your work has already been, Sandra. We are all very much looking forward to learning more about adaptation as renewal, about the transformative impact of Hamlet travels in the Global South.
So, Hamlet, as he travels. The topic of my talk today, it's really drawn from recent work on the impact of innovative theatre making around the world, on the meanings that are attributed to Shakespeare's work, and in particular, who or what we understand Hamlet to be. The field of adaptation studies historically has tended to rely on ideas of influence that tend to affirm the original work or the source, however unwittingly. But more recently, scholars have begun to recognize the impact of creative work that emerges from what we might call the non-traditional centres of Shakespeare theatre practice, in, you know, shifting the landscape, shifting the terrain, particularly in acknowledging the ways that a more global Shakespeare has been able to address questions of social justice. And in relation to Hamlet specifically, I've argued that in previous work that this brooding, introspective post-Freudian Hamlet, who scholars have spoken of as the prototype of modern Western subjectivity, in fact has increasingly been made to reckon with the struggles of dispossession, political turmoil, and surveillance, and so on, as a result of a much more complex, much more varied, much more plural creative environment around the world. And so today I'd like to reflect on the impact of Shakespeare's global travels on the figure of Hamlet and on the play's capacity to effect discomforting social critique when his story is reimagined by theatre practitioners and filmmakers who are alert to the political imperatives of their own histories, particularly in the Global South, where the effects of colonial struggles continue to shape everyday life. So for today's talk, I'll allude briefly to four particular contexts, and that is apartheid South Africa, very briefly, then India-administered Kashmir, which is the setting of Vishal Bajaj's 2014 film Heder, then Brazil, through a discussion of Zé Kelso's radical Hamlet from the 90s, and it was staged again in the early 2000s. And then post-independent Nigeria, as is explored in the play Wesu Hamlet, or The Resurrection of Hamlet, by the renowned Nigerian playwright Femi Oshafisan. Contemporary film and theatre practice suggests that the play's engagement with injustice and dispossession has re-emerged now as an interpretive concern, and that this has become evident, actually, in if one look at some of the stagings in what one might have, think of as the kind of center of Shakespeare's universe. And I'm thinking, for example, of the National Theatre production in London in 2010, which had this tremendous emphasis on surveillance. Rory Kinnear was never alone on stage. There were always, dark-clad men with walkie-talkies checking up on him, for example. And also in the 2009 film that was based on the Royal Shakespeare Company's production, which incorporated some shots that were disconcertingly viewed through the lens of a security camera, and we could see that in the in what was shown on screen. So I'd like to start by proposing a set of terms with which to understand the relationship of influence and transformation that results from Hamlet's availability as a figure to think with in many corners of the world. And to do that, I'm going to turn to Edward Said's ideas about travelling theory, which we will be discussing tomorrow in more detail, because I think that they offer a useful way to conceptualise the process. That is to say, the process of how theories are accommodated, appropriated, and then transformed by the way that they are taken up and challenged in new contexts. Because if we extend Said's argument to canonical literatures, it offers a way to think of the impact of mobility on Shakespeare's best-known play, and potentially also other works of literature and cultural forms. Because having travelled around the world, Hamlet has been claimed as ours, as kin, by communities that the playwright himself couldn't possibly have imagined. The many varied incarnations of the play have pluralized Hamlet, have rendered the play set adrift, in a sense, irrevocably untethered to any putative source, have made what we understand Hamlet to be that much more complex. The difficulty with Said's model is that if it's read too literally, it would seem to reinforce a model of influence that would seem to move from the perceived center outwards to the perceived periphery. But in fact, his position is much more radical than that. It recognizes a path of influence in the opposite direction too. For Sayyid, the vocabulary of what he calls borrowing and adaptation, he says, is not adequate to be able to really understand and speak respectfully of the transformations that theory undergoes in new contexts. And this is in a piece in which he revisits his initial thoughts on traveling theory 2 decades after first proposing it. And in this new piece, Traveling Theory Reconsidered, he points to the profound sense of what he calls affiliation that occurs when ideas travel to spaces with histories of their own and then return with new associations. So I want to just give a moment to give you a sense of Sayyid's argument by giving attention to the example that he offers, because it seems significant that, you know, the particularity of his example, you know, helps to explain his idea when he says, when he offers an analysis of Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, which he says takes in and transforms the Marxism of Georges Lukács, what Sayyid calls the, quote, manifestly European subject-object dialectic, it can't find an easy purchase within Fanon's revolutionary Algeria. The history of anti-colonial struggle and the violence of racialized subjectivities in that context necessarily extends and transforms the subject-object relation as Lukács had conceived of it from within revolutionary Hungary. Now, for Lukács, his concern with the European class system had not had to consider the figure of the colonized so-called native. Lukács hadn't really had to deal with the impact of race in the class struggle. So for Sayyid, in offering an analysis of Fanon, Fanon's introduction of the new complication of racial nationalism does more than just add kind of texture and interest, sense of variety, or whatever, to Lukácsian theory. Rather, he goes further in recognizing the way in which Fanon is able to recognize the limitation of Lukácsian theory, and that in this new context, there's a need for a more nuanced argument, a greater degree of complexity, and which results in a kind of renewal of Lukács. At least this is the language that Sayyid uses. Let's have a further look at it. Notice that for Sayyid, the model of influence does not assume that Fanon's treatment of subject-object relations in the colonial context occupies a kind of a secondary tier, or as Sayyid puts it, a belated second degree. When Sayyid affirms the relevance of Lukácsian theory to the scene of colonial struggle, interestingly, he doesn't attribute to Lukács a kind of a facile universalism. It's not that Lukács is universal or universally applicable. And in this sense, it marks a kind of a contrast from the language of universalism that has dogged Shakespeare studies. Because whereas adaptations of Shakespearean drama historically have tended to generate approval for Shakespeare's sustained relevance and universality, but for Sayyid, the discovery that post-independence Algeria is a generative context within which to reconsider the Lukácsian subject-object dialectic, thanks to Fanon's intervention, this is not a sign of Lukács's universal applicability or his remarkable relevance for contexts outside of his own. Instead, as Sayyid understands it, Fanon's engagement with Lukács helps to extend and to challenge Lukácsian thought beyond Europe. And he uses the language of, he talks about it reigniting the most potent core. In a process of reinvigoration that Said considers central to intellectual life in the late 20th century. So this process of reinvigorating is central for Said to intellectual life. And it's not an add-on or a little, this language of adaptation or so on, something that comes after. It actually takes us back to the core. Its most fiery, potent core is how Said describes it. So I think Said offers us a helpful model for thinking about Hamlet's travels this far into the 21st century. The mutuality that Said recognizes in the encounter between anti-colonial thought and the Marxist dialectic is helpful, I think, when considering the transformative impact of Hamlet's travels and the solidarities and the resistances that new interpretive contexts across the global south have yielded. When Hamlet's dilemma has been taken up in contexts like Indian-administered Kashmir, as we'll see now, post-independence Nigeria, anti-colonial Brazil, and South Africa in the aftermath of apartheid, the play's confrontation with what Hamlet laments as the oppressor's wrong, it becomes politically inflected without necessarily losing its psychological acuity. And I spoke last week in the postgraduate class about Hamlet performance history and the dominance of the Freudian framework, which has made it difficult for 21st century, even in the 20th century, for audiences to recognize the kind of urgent political questions that the play brings to our attention. So I won't go over that again in any detail now, but I thought I would just refer to it quickly for those who weren't there, just as a background to what follows. You may be familiar with the kinds of insights that Margrethe de Grazia brought to scholarly attention a while ago when she looked at the way in which Hamlet was received in its own time, and then the effect of editing practices in the 18th century and also subsequent, the reception history. So what it is that Coleridge had to say when he elevated Hamlet, but Shakespeare in general, for this kind of attention that was given to characterization and this category of the psychological that somehow elevated Shakespeare to something like the standing that we recognize today. But the difficulty, of course, is that it had the effect in relation to Hamlet of abstracting the main character from the plot, and Margrethe de Grazia has done such an amazing job in her argument is that this effect of abstracting Hamlet from the land-driven plot has meant that audiences have not been able to recognize questions of dispossession and political turmoil. And to the degree that she argues, she speculates, perhaps Shakespeare's own audiences would have been alert to. And in the class last week, I also spoke about the impact of performance history, the staging choices that have reinforced a key aspect of this play since Freud elevated this category of the psychological, discovering. And there's this remarkable moment when he writes about his experience of sitting in the audience and suddenly recognizing the impact he imagines of Oedipal repression on Hamlet's inability to act. And so for the last 100 years, this reinforcing of the psychological has had an enormous impact on what it is that we understand Hamlet to be. And I showed some images of these very inward-looking, angst-ridden stagings of Hamlet. So it seems useful to recognize that that what we understand Hamlet to be has to do with certain histories, performance histories, and so on. And for the purpose of my argument today, I would like to draw our attention to the way, the impact that that a different set of histories has had on what we understand Hamlet to be, and that is as Hamlet has travelled and been taken up in contexts, in new contexts. These new concerns, or in fact not new concerns, but old concerns with questions of power and dispossession have become elevated again. And that in a sense, the you know, this tortured self-doubt and Hamlet's fantasy of taking up arms against a sea of troubles, that it has gained a new sense of urgency in the global south, where specific contexts make it very easy to understand him as inhabiting a world that is controlled by, you know, punitive security systems that support an illegitimate regime, for example, or where in a context like Kashmir, it becomes very easy to experience his world through the lens that that highlights the fear that is generated when you're living in a world that is under the surveillance of an occupying army, for example. Or if I think about Oshafisan's play in Nigeria, where we get to witness Hamlet's experience of the corrosion of social and environmental health that accompanies the corrupting presence of multinational corporations. And so the play's preoccupation with political power and succession has made it an uncomfortably resonant work for contemporary politics around the world. Theatre makers and filmmakers have been able to exploit those resonances creatively, working in sympathy with Shakespeare to draw attention to injustice within contemporary contexts around the world in a manner that both affirms and also transforms Shakespeare's creative vision. So I'd like to look at some of these specific case studies now to see how the play's concern with the abuse of power and dispossession has made it an effective vehicle for protest against tyranny. And here briefly, as an example, is a 2006 production that was directed by Janet Sussman for the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Baxter Theatre Company, where critics were quick to pick up echoes of Zimbabwe's aging dictator, Robert Mugabe, in the portrayal of the murderous Claudius by veteran actor John Carney. And for Sussman, the director, she says, the parallels are best articulated in terms of power. She says, tyranny is also at home in Africa. For other critics, like the scholar Peter Holland, the significant parallel to be identified was between, quote, the righteous old Hamlet doubled with Claudius by John Carney, and of course, Nelson Mandela. And what's interesting to see is that the resonances, as these scholars speak about them, are mutual, because Mandela lends to old Hamlet his kind of righteous dignity, his ethical probity, and his statesmanship. And in this production, the appearance of the young Prince Hamlet in the khaki uniform of a prisoner turns Hamlet's antic disposition into the subversive strategies of a political activist in a way that was really resonant in post-apartheid South Africa. Vishal Bhardwaj's masterful filmic adaptation of Hamlet, which was set in Kashmir in the 1990s, offers a rich case study to reflect on the resonances of contemporary Shakespearean adaptation. So his film, Hedder, was released in 2014, and it explores the surprising resonances of Hamlet in a very particular time and place, and that is India-administered Kashmir in the 1990s, where people disappear without trace, and where the military police torture dissidents with impunity. What's interesting about this reimagining of Hamlet is that it invokes both ancient and contemporary time frames. Simultaneously, the creative palette drew on some traditional folk elements such as dance and music and puppetry. But then there was also really brought into stark relief the disturbing political realities of contemporary life in India-administered Kashmir. The film's setting makes all too visible the pain and repression resulting from the current political strife amidst evocative scenes showing the extraordinary natural beauty of Kashmir. What was so interesting about this film is that the personal register of Heda's crisis allows audiences to bear witness to the more public elements, the political repression, the impact of this on his intimate world. So in a sense, the film is clearly making a significant intervention on behalf of the Kashmiri people. And it makes plain that this choice between a creative focus on, you know, the Oedipal drama at the heart of the play, as Freud would have it, and on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the more politically incisive elements, you know, the idea that Denmark has become a prison, that this is a false opposition, in a sense, that it's that we can rather see that the pain of the Kashmiri people is a matter of political struggle, and it is etched in the contours of their most intimate lives. It's both and. The struggle of this Hamlet as Hedir, the struggle that he faces, is always already both political and personal. And from the start, it's clear that the drama unfolds under a state of political surveillance, where army-controlled checkpoints govern the movements of ordinary citizens, and what is worse, where the army can round up whole villages. At gunpoint, just by calling all the men who have to have their identity documents to go and be checked. And as we witnessed right from the start, you know, this is a world where men and women can be marched off and subjected to arbitrary brutality, and that the military is all powerful. And in fact, they are empowered to act with impunity by the infamous a law that was enacted in 1990 called the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which is always spoken of, often spoken of in the film as by its acronym AFSPA. And in this film, Hedda's father is a doctor who has performed an emergency appendectomy on a Kashmiri dissident. He thinks of himself as apart from the conflict, but of course that choice draws him into the conflict. He's then singled out in an identity parade and he is taken away. We hear later that he was tortured and killed, betrayed by his brother, who had political and obviously personal aspirations. The Ophelia character, Arshi, is an investigative journalist. So we hear a great deal of critique from her in her writings about the political context that we are bearing witness to. Her father is a military officer with intelligence responsibilities, and of course he reports to the Indian Army leadership. So in that sense is an ambiguous character. For a while, we travel with Hedda to various government offices, to morgues and riverside military encampments that are set up to deal with the increasing number of dead bodies while he searches for his father. And all of this is set to Bajwaj's evocative music. There's this beautiful song about the beautiful Jhelum River, which has been turned into a bloody grave, and it registers as a song of mourning. As part of Hedda's search for his father, the film takes us To government offices, we get to see the silent protests of survivors whose placards asked, "Where are our loved ones?" And when Heather declares his intention to look for his father, and his friend Salman say, "Where will you look for him? In camps? In prisons?" He offers this response that echoes Hamlet, saying, "All of Kashmir is a prison. I will look for him everywhere." Now, reviewers, of course, were very quick to recognize the film's potential to spark controversy. For example, there was a byline in a Guardian review by Jason Burke, which alerts readers to the fact that the film, quote, includes graphic scenes of torture in Indian army camps and other human rights abuses by Indian officials. However, in interviews, the director, Bhardwaj, and also the lead actor, Shahid Kapoor, were at pains to underplay the political challenge of the play. I mean, admittedly, there were, you know, it was both, there was ambiguity in the way that both of them spoke about the play's political impact. In an interview, Bhardwaj also declared, he said, "If I am not a leftist, then I am not an artist." So he created this very strong association between his creative practice and his left-leaning political sensibilities. So we get a strong sense of his political investment in doing this work, but in another interview from around the same time, he leaves unanswered the interviewer's question about this notorious law, AFSPA, the way that it facilitated the disappearance of dissidents. And you know, the interviewer was asking him about his choice to make this part of the story. His answer just deftly sort of dodged the question, in a sense, and moved to a discussion of pain as something that is personal rather than political. He said, "As a filmmaker, you can't side with anybody. Of course, you have to empathize. And that's why Heder is a local Kashmiri, because we wanted to see it from the inside. We wanted to see it from the common man, who had nothing to do with either side of the conflict, who has no political agenda, who just wants to live his life peacefully, but he's pushed or dragged into the conflict." So you can see there that the way that he's characterizing it is that it's not a political film, or at least it wasn't intended that way, and that their emphasis is on Heder's personal struggle, the pain that he experiences by being unwittingly drawn into the conflict. And Kapoor, the Heder actor who plays Heder, also downplays the region's polarizing politics. He says, "It's not just about Kashmir. It could be any disturbed area. It's a very personal story." He says the film expresses, quote, "the journey of these individuals and connects with them at a very human level." So Shakespeare figures in these interviews as timeless, as the genius man, and so on. But what's interesting to me is that it's the work of the filmmaker that establishes the currency that brings to this story the creative and political force here and now. And despite what Bhardwaj and Kapoor say about the impact of the film, it's not quiescent. It's not a quiet film around these politically uncomfortable questions. In a sense, it's not surprising that they are at pains to downplay the politics in public. You know, the film was subjected to the censor board. The censors required 40 cuts to Bhardwaj's film. And there's a sense in which perhaps all this foregrounding of Shakespeare is maybe quite useful, because it lends it a certain kind of cultural capital, elevated status, in a sense. It is perhaps somewhat protective. Because in truth, the film does draw our attention to astonishing abuses of power. And for example, the film the Hedda's performance of Feigned Madness in the town square includes a fierce tirade against the brutality of the occupying forces. And it's spoken publicly, loudly, almost as a kind of a dance into the town square with a large crowd that had gathered. And it was interesting to hear Badra talk about working with the crowd, that in fact the crowd needed no prompting and that they were right there. They were ordinary Kashmiri citizens. They were not trained actors. And yet, as Hedda shouted, for example, worked them up into saying, he would shout out, what do we want? And the crowd, was asked to, but they did it immediately, shout, freedom! When do we want it? Now! And then he would say, freedom to the right, freedom to the left, and the crowd would be clapping. And it's quite an electrifying scene, in fact. And it was so interesting to hear that it required very little prompting. No rehearsing. And Arti, her work as a journalist, draws attention to the sham election and to the alarming statistics about the widespread disappearances and the extensive powers that were accorded the Indian Army as a result of this Afzba law. And in that scene too, we get to hear that, in fact, Hedder, in his antic disposition, in his feigned madness, takes the microphone and blasts out the detail of this law. For example, Rule 4, Section 5, any person taken into custody under this act shall be handed over to the officer in charge of the nearest police station with the least possible delay. So it really adds to the power of what its critique is, and it emerges out of its direct quote from the act itself. This is not story. So Kashmir is far from being a neutral setting for this version of Hamlet's struggle, and its protracted deadly conflict is an intimate part of Hedda's crisis. Within the context of India-administered Kashmir, even the most private of relations are not spared the impact of political turmoil. And it's not that Bajwaj gives no attention to the discomforting intimacy between Hedda and his mother, and the distressing impact on Hedda of his mother's hasty marriage. We witness that too. But what Bajwaj's film makes clear is that in this repressive context, the personal is intertwined with the political. Hedda's crisis allows audiences to witness the impact of political oppression on his most intimate world. Despite Bajwaj and Kapoor's attempts to emphasize the personal elements at its core, their choice to set Hamlet's story within Kashmir necessarily confronts audiences with the complex history of the region and with the pain associated with its ongoing intractable conflict. So let me turn now to Nigeria, where Hamlet's confrontation with predatory greed and manipulation finds a new iteration in post-independence Africa through the work of the renowned Nigerian playwright Femi Oshofisan, who is an icon of social justice and an anti-corruption advocate in Nigeria. His play, We Saw Hamlet, or The Resurrection of Hamlet, draws on Yoruba mythology and oral culture, as well as Shakespeare, explicitly. There's also this really interesting weaving together of these different strands of influence. And a rich kind of creative palette that he draws on. And in the way that he stages structures the play, the messenger in the play's prologue refers to echoes of Shakespeare's stories. And then he goes on to summons characters who are given the names Hamlet, Claudius, and Ophelia. But here, Hamlet's story of loss, dispossession, and impossible revenge is repurposed to bring to light to what Oshofi-san has called the repetitive cycle of violence that plays out in the aftermath of colonialism. The play exposes the corrupting influences of modern-day corporations that have put the social order in post-independence Nigeria at risk. Hamlet warns his counterpart in the play. We see these interesting conversations between characters that are identified as Shakespeare's and then their contemporary sort of counterparts. In this case, Leto. Hamlet warns Leto that he will need much courage. And Ophelia calls for compassion in a moment that presages the play's progressive gender politics and gives attention to the way that women are made vulnerable through patriarchal social and economic structures. But what is perhaps most compelling about the play is the way in which it draws attention to the corrupting influences of foreign enterprises. In addition then to the, you know, the complexity of the familial reconfigurations that come about as a result of the old king's death and his ambitious younger brother's installation into the royal household. So in Oshofi-san's play, a proposed factory for tobacco products has been rejected by the elders, who are alert to the health risks and to the fact that they are being preyed upon by multinational corporations trying to create new markets in less health-conscious and litigious communities. The play exposes the predatory nature of foreign so-called investment, you know, exposing the extent to which it really is just a searching out of new markets. And it links contemporary exploitation to the long history of European predation in Africa. Claudius traces the link between the current manipulations of the tobacco company and the so-called adventurers of old. And of course, that was the word that was used by the early would-be colonialists in the 16th and 17th century, going across the seas to look for new lands, new markets. And Claudius is alert to this. Speaking as a European, he addresses Ayibi, the usurping king, his counterpart, and he says, "Those slave dealers of old, what else do you think they called the mirrors and beads and guns and whiskey that we brought them? Yes, those second-hand shirts and waistcoats. Were they not items of civilization, just like your tobacco company?" So there's a tremendous sense of irony there about the value, the corrupting influence of what is brought into these new contexts. The character that is identified as Hamlet has the opportunity to reflect on the dilemma of how to act in the face of injustice and self-doubt. In a conversation with his counterpart Leto, he says, but it's Leto who replies, saying, "To be or not to be, that is not the question, that is an evasion." In other words, there's a real sort of call to action that is made, that it is possible to imagine in Oshofi-san's play. But in a moment of mutual recognition, Hamlet acknowledges the nature of the dilemma that, quote, "doubt paralyzes action, this need to be sure and to be just," that there is this difficulty to act. In this context of reckoning with injustice, Hamlet has wisdom to share. He says that restitution, quote, "can come in other forms than that of vengeance." And so in confronting us with these scenes of contention and in punctuating the unfolding events with interventions from Shakespeare's characters, as they ask their counterparts to consider carefully how best to proceed, the play invites us to pause and to recognize the effects of unexamined action in the face of injustice. Oshofi-san invites us to imagine the works as quite literally in conversation. So there's this really interesting invitation to Shakespeare and to Shakespeare's characters to be a part of the conversation. So it's not a repudiation of Shakespeare, it's an invoking And, you know, he makes it very clear that the inspiration for some of his thinking, some of his creative practice, is from Shakespeare's play. And it's useful to think about how Chavisan talks about his creative practice. He articulates his approach to adaptation in terms that I think recall Said's language with which we began. He declares that the adaptations I'm inspired to write from the impulse of a powerful and mutual recognition, like the thrill of love or an unplanned reunion between long separated friends. And however bold or Chavisan's reworking of Shakespeare's play might be, it's this sense of affinity that he says propels the work. And this affinity is akin to the bonds between, quote, blood ancestors. Chavisan, in an interview, he characterizes adaptation as a delicious understanding, a bond of love, and a glowing accord. And of course, it carries this language carries an echo of another conception of cultural appropriation as filiation and love, however contestatory. And for that, we need to travel to Brazil. And I know that here in Constance, in your postgraduate class, you have already given attention to this astonishing way of thinking about cultural interaction in the form of cultural anthropophagy, which is a model of cultural absorption that came to prominence with the publication of Oswald de Andrade's Cannibalist Manifesto in 1928. The manifesto asserts with relish the right to consume the cultural forms that Brazilians have encountered through colonial conquest and to make them their own as an act of cultural insurgency. It conceives of its resistance in radical terms as obliteration through consumption. Andrade puts it as absorption of the sacred enemy, and so on. But for all its performative contrariness in celebrating vengeance as a kind of a feasting on human flesh, the manifesto imagines affiliative connection too. The language that he uses is filiation and love as the outcome. As he declares, the cannibal instinct moves from carnal to elective and creates friendship, affective, love. Despite what it may seem, this is not a contradiction, but it's in keeping with the Amazonian cosmology on which it is based. The Cannibalist Manifesto conceives of the consumption of the enemy as an act of honor, the incorporation, quite literally, of what is most excellent in the enemy. Into the self. And I'm quoting here, absorption of the sacred enemy, that he may be transformed into a totem. This specter of consumption presents a provocative confrontation with the cannibal, that figure with which explorers and colonialists peddled their accounts of New World encounters and justified their genocidal conquests. And so it becomes, for D'Andrade, a very powerful figure with which to stage resistance. And my interest in bringing to your attention the next case study from Brazil is in thinking about how this has become a model for a form of adaptation that is, you know, provocative, and quite electrifying, in fact, this model of appropriation as consumption. So an especially bold example, or powerful example, is the staging of Hamlet. There's a hyphen in between the two not actually written up there, but it needs right at the bottom. There we go. Hamlet. So I'll signal that in the way that I pronounce it as I'm talking. So it's this really interesting, bold staging by Zé Kelso in 1993 and again in 2001 at his Teatro Oficina theatre space in Sao Paulo. The part of what is revolutionary about the staging is the theatre space itself, which is inspired by a kind of a revolutionary architecture. It's almost, this Teatro Oficina is almost carnivalesque in that it disrupts established staging norms and the lines of sight that they install into the theatre space. So here everything is deliberately, radically open to view in a structure that has done away with seats, curtains, and even a stage. So you can imagine it's somewhat chaotic, but really interesting in the reversals that it enacts. This refiguring of the performance space creates a sense of movement through a thoroughfare within a close gathering of which the audience are, you know, they're very much a part of that. So it creates a sort of a sense of crowd also on multiple levels because they are on multiple planes. At the spaces for people to be looking down from above as well as from below. So multiple viewing levels, multiple planes, and the effect is amplified in the visual recording that is available on the MIT Global Shakespeare Video and Performance Archive, because the way in which it's recorded, there's a roving camera which moves in and out of the acting troupe and also sort of on different visual planes, high and low, close and distance. So there's no stable vantage point. There's no stable place from which to view, which is very different from the way in which many of the staged productions that the National Theatre have made available. Probably, I would imagine that I remember during the early days of lockdown, there was a weekly National Theatre production that I would watch on a Sunday evening. It's a much more settled camera. Not here. The camera roves in and out, up and down. So Zé Kelso's radical vision for Hamlet adopts cultural anthropophagy's conception of resistance as consumption. And scholars have been alert to the, you know, the way in which it is provocative and transformative. Christiana Busatis Smith, for example, describes cannibalism as a critical, aesthetic, and political practice which displaces notions of source and influence, original and copy. And in fact, Zé Kelso's conception of the theatre space itself is part of this radical undoing of established theatre conventions. It's a reinvention that is designed to achieve a more confronting encounter, which is also how Paul Heritage has described it. He's a theatre practitioner who has established strong connections between the UK and Brazil. He describes his experience of watching Hamlet at the Teatro Oficina in the 1990s. In an interview, he says that in his Hamlet production of 1993, Zé Kelso did not just reinterpret Hamlet in a highly anthropophagic way. He also gave an anthropophagical interpretation of theatre itself. In Zé Kelso's Teatro Oficina, the actor-theatre relation precedes the text. It precedes the formal ritual of theatre. While in Britain, the ritual of theatre always comes first as the determining factor of the audience's experience. And this, he says, kills any attempt to reinvent. He says, Zé Kelso challenged what I knew not just about Shakespeare, but about theatre itself. So this transformative encounter is much more profound than just any one given play or playwright. So Zé Kelso's Hamlet blurs the boundaries between performers and audience. The audience are immediately drawn into the music making and even the action. By providing the rhythm and, you know, small individual gestures like lighting the candles and chanting when called upon to do so. So the actors involve them in the creation of the scene. The actors move in and out of the main performance space, which is set up as a thoroughfare in the midst of a large gathering. And the nature of the perversion that weighs on Hamlet's conscience takes in the social, the political, the environmental, and indeed the cosmic. Hamlet says, "Now we are receiving identical signs of terrible events," he cautions. "Prologue of the ill omen coming, mortal catastrophes, heaven and earth manifesting together in different climatic regions and here as well. And everyone is implicated, everyone is at risk." Even Claudius is willing to make reference to this dangerous state, so this presaging of climate catastrophe, which is disconnected and out of axis. But Claudius's rage at Hamlet's self-pity and grief finds reason to accuse him of cosmic wrong and rebellion. But there's this very powerful image that Zeke Kelso's Hamlet offers up, fearing that theatre itself has become, quote, "an ill-treated garden where only the seeds of bad things of nature grow." Hamlet articulates his disgust at feminine sexuality and the degeneracy of the world in terms that emphasize bodily rotting and the consumption of carrion. It's quite a discomforting play to watch. I invite you. It's available. He says, "If the sun, being a god, conceives worms in a dead bitch sucking its carrion," he warns Polonius, "don't let your daughter in the sun." And in his excitement at welcoming the players, he exclaims, "Let's make a vulture. Let's make like a vulture and fly over the first carrion that appears." But what's interesting is that the sense of bodily rotting and consumption is also a source of pleasure, rather provocatively, and power in the production, particularly when it's celebrated as ritual. For example, at the end of Act 3, Scene 2, when spirits appear out of the earth bearing with raised arms a piece of flesh and singing the words traditionally spoken by Hamlet, "Now the witching time of night begins, graveyards yawn, and hell releases its pests infecting this world." The infection is imagined as a kind of an alchemy, bringing down the powerful. And at this point, Hamlet cries, "Now I can drink hot blood," at which points the spirits then resume and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on. So it's quite wild. And Zeke Kelso appeared in the production himself as the ghost of old Hamlet, dressed as Ogum, a figure from Yoruba mythology, representing the essence of divine justice and truth on earth. So also there's a rich creative palette that the production is drawing on. Even as the production confronts audiences with the excesses of carnal appetite, it invokes figures of Nigerian divinity, such as Oxum, spirit of the feminine river goddess, to offer a restorative reading, as the scholar Smith that I pointed out earlier has put it. A restorative reading of Ophelia's tragedy. And the way in which it does this is by offering what scholars have spoken of as a sex-positive reading, in that Ophelia finds agency and pleasure in sex work rather than suicide. So this production reimagines social transformation on behalf of those who have been disempowered. It does not only conceive of justice for Hamlet, who is, you know, clearly the dispossessed son of a murdered king. But it draws attention to the way in which all the world is a prison. And Hamlet is given the opportunity to speak about an injustice on behalf of many. He says, when he's talking about the whole world being a prison, Denmark is a prison, a very big one, in which there are many cells, halls, and slave quarters. Denmark is one of the worst. But in fact, the whole world has these elements of unjust imprisonment. And even though this production violates the incest taboo in its treatment of Oedipal desire in ways that are quite discomforting, the Oedipal tension doesn't supplant the play's concern with social injustice. So again, we see this production being able to imagine, to draw on both of these preoccupations. This radical conception informing the staging of Hamlet as ritual practice, as consumption of the other, points to the radical alterity that has increasingly begun to confront Hamlet on his world travels. And also, it also points to the generative effect of this on contemporary interpretations of the play. The conceptual framework that emerged with the dominance of the Freudian psychoanalytical lens has increasingly had to attend to concerns of dispossession, tyranny, and injustice in the play, as theatre making in the aftermath of colonial dispossession has left its mark. And now, increasingly, mainstream productions of Shakespeare's play are foregrounding this critique of illegitimate power, which lies at the heart of Shakespeare's play. And I'm sorry, I meant to show this to you earlier. But given that I'm just bringing this to a close, this is still from the National Theatre production with Rory Kinnear as Hamlet, never alone on stage, always under surveillance. So surveillance and political power have resurfaced as core to the play's concerns. As the play has been taken up in contexts where the complexities and inequalities of a decolonizing world are kind of front and center. And my argument is not that it has entirely displaced this preoccupation with the psychological, as Margrethe de Grazia argued so persuasively in 2009. It's just no longer quite so clear that one can talk about the removal from view of the politics behind what she called the land-driven plot. Because as it's been taken up and reimagined in contexts around the world, contexts of real struggle, it's become easier and also more necessary, more urgent to recognize a range of issues related to injustice, dispossession, land appropriation, repression, disenfranchisement, and so on. That in fact are situated at the heart of Hamlet's anguish. And it seems that the histories of dispossession and injustice in the global south have created, therefore, powerful contexts for the transformation and the renewal of Hamlet. In contexts where disenfranchised people have had to develop strategies for resistance in the face of injustice and in the face of brutal suppression of dissent, theatre makers have found in Hamlet a generative figure to think with. Within a bond, and I'd like to, you know, return to Said's language here, a bond of affiliation, Said and Oshafisan, affiliation that has enriched and unsettled Hamlet and his world. Thank you.